This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living with me, Tee Shao Eek. We are talking today about how muscles age. Now, if you're over the age of 30, chances are you may already be losing muscle. Just like the rest of the body, our muscles age along with the rest of us. So we have consultant orthopedic surgeon Dr. Rajesh Singh in the studio to give us a 101 on muscles and perhaps talk us through how to prevent or whether it's possible to reverse muscle loss as we get older. Good afternoon, Dr. Rajesh. How are you today?
Very well, Shaik. Thank you. Happy to be here.
You know, you are a little bit, your monthly show today, this month is a little bit later. And I apologize for that because it coincided with Chinese New Year. We had to move a few things around, but you've managed to squeak in just before Chinese New Year ends.
Yes, yes. It's nice to be here in the old year and I'll be here again in the new year.
Yes, you will. So our phone lines are open. You can call us if you have any questions for Dr. Rajesh, especially if it relates to muscle problems. Our number is 03-7733-2900. As usual, you can also WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. So we're talking about muscles, Dr. Rajesh. So let's start with perhaps defining what exactly is a muscle.
Okay. Muscle is contractile tissue. So any tissue that has the ability to generate a movement, you could consider a type of a muscle. Obviously, it's not strictly true because cells have organelles within them that can create movement. In the animal world, there's lots of tissues which store energy and release energy. Okay, so that's probably not really muscle. So muscle really means something that can change its shape to generate an effect that changes the world around it. So for practical purposes, in humans, we have skeletal muscle. And skeletal muscle, there's type 1 and type 2. Then we have cardiac muscle. And of course, then we have smooth muscle. And the difference here being that the fundamental building blocks are the same. It's how those building blocks are assembled that makes sort of a different kind of a structure.
What exactly are smooth muscles? That one's throwing me off a bit.
Okay. So if you, the sort of the terms that we use to describe muscles comes from their appearance under a microscope. So let's sort of take the basic muscle unit. There are two fibers, one sitting on top of another. And when you cause a chemical reaction, those two fibers will slide one on top of another to the effect of shortening. And then you apply a different chemical reaction and then those muscles relax. Okay. Now, in skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle, they are striations. So if you look at it under a microscope, you see lots of parallel lines. And then you see lines that cross them. So it looks almost like sort of brickwork, as it were. Mm. Whereas in smooth muscles, you don't see those striations that go down vertically. So you just sort of see these parallel bands. So that's why one's called smooth muscle, the other one's called striated muscle. It's just dependent on the microscopic appearance if you stain it and you look at it under a microscope. And that has a relevance in terms of how the muscle functions, how the muscle propagates its activity.
And you mentioned type 1 and type 2 skeletal muscles.
Okay, so this is probably, I think from an orthopedic perspective, skeletal muscle, we'll simplify it and say there are movement muscles and posture muscles. And I think that's sort of one of the really important concepts that people have to get. Last show we talked about just sitting down and how sitting down is an active kind of activity, mm-hmm. where your posture muscles are actually working in order to keep you upright. So a lot of the dysfunction that we have in the skeletal system comes from posture muscles. So people will come and say, I can push, 50 kilos, 100 kilos, I can do that bench press, mm-hmm. at the gym, but yet I've got this sort of fatigue at the end of the day. The reason why they have the fatigue is because the bench press uses an activity muscle, whereas their requirement to stand up during the day comes from a posture muscle. And the biomechanical behavior of the tissue is fundamentally different. The biological behavior of the tissue is fundamentally different.
So when you use that example of somebody saying, I can bench press this much, but I feel tired, does that mean they're using the muscles wrongly?
No, it means that they've developed the wrong sets of muscles. Mm. So when they go to the gym and they bench press, what they're doing is they're developing their power muscles. They're not developing their posture muscles. Mm. So in fact, it can be bad such that the power muscle or the movement muscles take over the function of the posture muscles.
Right.
Then people go, you know, I ache all the time. And that's one of the very interesting things that, you know, I got asked on the show once was, you know, you don't get a manual with the skeleton. You know, you don't sort of get...
Not at all. No. We don't get a manual with life.
No, we don't get a manual with life. But life's a little bit complicated. The skeletal system's a little bit complicated. But, you know, there could be a reasonable user manual for it. You know, much of that user manual's in musculoskeletal medicine and, you know, sort of in orthopedics. But the idea that, you know, there's different parts of the system and how we use one part of the system affects another part of the system should be relatively intuitive.
You know, so you're talking about somebody who may be developing the wrong kind of muscle with the activities that they do. Perhaps we take a few steps back and we could look at how muscles develop. And, you know, when does that process begin? When does it end?
Okay, so muscles obviously develop in utero. So, you know, babies in mummy's tummies start developing muscles. That's why they can kick and push and yank and all that sort of stuff. The heart muscle obviously starts from very, very early. So as soon as the sort of fetal heart is seen, that's literally a muscle starting to function. And, you know, if you think about it, that muscle starts and never stops until the end. So that's a pretty incredible function for something to be working nonstop for your entire lifetime. And that's basically, you know, heart muscle or cardiac muscle. So muscles, muscles are pre-programmed. So how... Your sort of physical makeup is largely genetic. That, of course, can be modified by your environment. I certainly remember working in a rural town while I was training in Australia, and that was a mining town. And it was not unusual to see men with the right limb significantly bigger than the other. You know, just because they start working in their early teens before they're skeletally mature, they work very hard. You know, the right dominant limb works harder than the non-dominant limb. And you sort of saw these guys which were like crabs, you know, with sort of one big claw and one small claw. So in that sort of situation, obviously, your size is partly genetically determined. But you can obviously change that. You know, you can change your genetic determinants by activity. So it's possible for your muscle to get very much bigger. And I think this is one of the beauties of the skeletal system. You know, you can get somebody who weighs, I don't know, 50 kilos, 70 kilos. He can double his weight. He can go to 100 kilos, 140 kilos just by building his muscle. And, you know, that's quite amazing. If you think about it, you can't double the size of your brain. You can't double the size of your eye. You can't double the size of your liver. Can't double the size of your kidney. You can double the size of your muscle. You know, it's the only sort of organ that you can actually keep growing ad infinitum, theoretically.
Does that apply to the cardiac muscle as well?
No, it doesn't. So cardiac muscle doesn't... well, it does actually. That's not entirely true. Cardiac muscle... responds to the same forces that normal skeletal muscle does. So if you work a heart muscle against pressure, the heart muscle becomes thicker. But that's bad for the heart because then when the heart muscle is thicker, it's stiffer. And then it doesn't subserve its function within the pump. So the short answer is yes, but you know, for people getting the idea of, ooh, you know, doctor said my blood pressure is high, my heart's working hard, that must be good and not good.
And neither does an enlarged heart bode well for you.
No. So an enlarged heart means that either that sort of bag of muscle has become loose and floppy, or the bag of muscle, the walls have become too thick. So in either situation, the heart doesn't pump well.
But in relation to the other muscles that people build up, is there a threshold that you shouldn't cross? Is there a limit?
Have you seen some really grotesque bodybuilders?
I have.
You have, haven't you?
I hate to use the word grotesque, but it baffles the imagination, the extent to which that, you know.
Yes. And, you know, that's not obviously all organic. You know, there's some sort of pharmaceutical help in achieving that. But practically, no, actually. I can't think of any physical limit beyond the fact that, you know, you can't move if your muscles are really too big, right? Because you see these sort of overly large individuals in the gym and they're sort of waddling. And they're waddling because they're just so packed full of muscle that they can't move their joints correctly.
And so then conversely, is there a point that muscles stop growing or they go into the process of aging and loss?
Yep. So like everything else in the body, it's sort of time dependent. So when you're born, obviously there's some muscles which are going to grow. Even if you do nothing, almost nothing, they're still going to keep growing. And the people who have sort of genetic predispositions to being muscularly large, and in those people, you don't have to do anything. And certainly the Pacific Islanders, the Polynesians, the Fijians, you know, my entire patient cohort in New Zealand, they're just amazing. You'd see this sort of huge guy with gigantic muscles come in. And you go, do you work? I go, nah, bro, just chilling. but that's, I mean, that's his genetic potential, right? It also means his uric acid's through the roof. But, you know, that's a different story. So people's muscles will grow up to a certain age. They will mature irrespective of what you do very much or not very much. But then the maintenance is where the key comes in. So let me just tell you a little bit about the structure of muscle. It's quite interesting. Let's take the analogy of a tree. So let's say that you have a tree and each individual leaf on the tree is a muscle cell. Then you've got all the branches that connect all the leaves, and then all the branches that connect those branches, and so on and so on and so forth until you get to a trunk. That is basically what the smallest unit of a muscle fiber is. Okay, so the fiber is like the tree trunk, and then everything else is the sort of contractile elements of it. So if you imagine a tree, how big the tree grows kind of depends on how well you look after it and how much you nurture it. So that analogy is relevant to muscle with sports, for example. So if you're younger, you do more sports, it means you have more branches, and on those branches you have more leaves. So later on when you get older and the leaves tend to drop, if you fertilize the tree, you get more leaves on the tree. And that sort of, that idea is called muscle memory. So what I find is, if I'm treating people who were active once in their life, who had good muscle bulk once in their life, I can see it clearly on the ultrasound. You know, when I have a look at their muscles, I can see lots of branches and lots of points where leaves were. If I have people who weren't very active early on, you don't see those branches. You don't see the sort of fibrous and connective elements. So when you talk about muscle just by itself, what you're talking about is the leaves. But really, when you talk about the whole unit, you're talking about that whole tree, as it were. And that's really an important sort of analogy or concept to get. Because if you have that sort of idea of the tree with the branches, then you understand how muscles work, right? So you've got a million of those trees with each tree trunk tied to another, and all the leaves contract, and that generates a force of movement. So different muscles are arranged differently, you know, so different muscles, based on what their biomechanical function is, those tree or sort of micro units are arranged differently. And in some muscles, you can generate a lot of force, but they move a very short distance. In other muscles, you can generate a little force, but they move a great distance. So this whole sort of muscle topic is really very, very big, because each individual muscle has a fascinating story in terms of its shape, where it comes from, where it goes, what its nerve supply is, what its blood supply is, what its function is, what its function is in movement, what its function is in posture, and what its relationship is in relation to all other muscles, sort of in that group of muscles that do work. So it's sort of, it's fascinating to look at muscles by themselves, but really in functional units.
So, I mean, you know, for us, we think about muscles as, yeah, something that enables movement for us. But I think the only time we really pay attention to it is when something goes wrong. You feel an ache, a pain, you think that you've sprained something or torn something. I mean, what's happening in the muscles when we feel those kinds of problems?
Okay, let me go through a very fascinating case I saw today. So this is a little lady who has a spine that's, you know, a little bit crooked because she's old. But she had pain in the back, and, you know, she sort of, she'd been going around the mill for years and years and years, and, you know, nobody, including myself, could work out where the pain came from. So having excluded all other things, I said to her, look, you know, let's consider maybe the pain is coming from muscle. So I looked at it under the ultrasound. I said, okay, well, you know, that little area there looks a little bit suspicious. So we stuck a needle in and gave her a drop of anesthetic exactly to that area, and she goes, oh, my pain's disappeared.
Immediately.
Immediately, right? So that was sort of one of these newer things that I'm starting to work out. The fact that muscle tears, if they don't heal correctly, are painful and chronically painful. And there's really very, it's very difficult to see because, you know, I've examined this lady lying down multiple times. Today I just said, look, you know, auntie, you stand up and you show me where the pain is. You make the movement to make the pain. So at that point, I actually caught where that structure was.
Right.
And that was quite interesting because the tear was from the muscle onto the fascia, right? So in this particular muscle, it takes origin from a soft structure above and a soft structure below. So it's like a sandwich. And then it inserts onto a central tendon onto bone. So she actually had a tear of muscle from fascia, and that muscle fascial tear was the thing that was giving her the pain. So getting back to our analogy, that'll be like saying that some of the bark from the tree has come away, right? And that's the thing that's giving her pain. So when you talk about muscle, you know, we're so far from the leaves, right? We're not even talking about any of those sort of contractile units. We're really talking about where the bark was on the tree trunk, and that's where her problem was. So when you say muscle pain, the problem can either be in the muscle itself, you know, that's one thing. Or the other thing can be that the muscles feel the pain of structures that they cross, particularly joints. So there's a law in anatomy called Hilton's Law, and Hilton's Law says that the nerve that supplies the joint also supplies the muscles that cross the joint. So consequently, if somebody has a problem in a joint, whom else did I see today? Oh, I saw a gentleman with elbow pain. So actually, you know, he had forearm pain and arm pain, but the root cause of his problem was in his elbow. So when I examined him, he said, look, it always hurts here and here, above and below the elbow.
Right.
So when I examined him, I said, look, you've obviously got restriction of movement of the elbow joint. And, you know, on close inspection, you have arthritis of the elbow joint. So it's actually joint pain that's manifest in the muscle.
Right.
So that's sort of one of the funny things about muscles. They are subject to lots and lots of regulatory and feedback mechanisms. So like this guy, his muscles around the elbow joint, which is arthritic, were very much smaller. Now, the question that one may ask is, well, why is that? Why does damage of a joint cause the muscles to waste? And wasting means that, you know, the sort of what you would expect the muscle to be given the person's sort of build, size, stage in life, activities, that the muscle is much smaller than that. So that's what we call wasting. And the answer is we don't really know yet. You know, it seems to be some sort of protective mechanism where the body says, if I create muscles to move the joint, I'm going to damage the joint some more. So I won't create muscles. I'll sort of, I'll inhibit the creation of muscles so that the joint doesn't get more damaged. But that sort of actually falls short of the intended aim, because if you force the joint to move that has poor muscles, the joint gets more damaged. So then it becomes a sort of chicken and egg story.
It does, it does. But the clue really seems to lie in movement, how you move it and how your movement then affects the way you experience the pain.
Yeah, I think it's the pain is manifest in movement. And, you know, that's one of the things that I sort of really like about the whole sort of orthopedic thing. Because you should be able to say to people, recreate the pain. You know, 99% or 90% of the reason why people go to see an orthopedic surgeon is because it hurts somewhere.
Yes.
Right? You know, it either hurts somewhere, it's weak, it's tingly, or it's deformed. And pain's by far the most important thing, or most common thing, I would say. So the whole idea of the sources of pain and muscle being a potential source of pain is really very, very important. And it can be in the way of muscle imbalance. So I saw a colleague of mine who had shoulder pain. And, you know, she's a surgeon and she was doing an operation. And after the operation, she said, my shoulder started hurting in the front. And she couldn't work out why it was. So, you know, we did the usual, you know, got rid of her pain initially. That wasn't very hard. But then I said to her, look, the problem in your ball and socket joint is the ball's not centered in the socket. And the ball's not centered in the socket because of the nature of our work, we're always slumped over a little bit. So since we're always slumped over a little bit, the muscles at the back get a little bit lax and get a little bit weak.
Right, and it's not contracting.
Well, firstly, it's not doing its posture function, right? And because it's not doing its posture function, the ball and socket joint aren't perfectly aligned. Right. So if you stress a ball and socket joint that's not perfectly aligned, then, you know, you injure something. So that's sort of the context of muscle is really a lot bigger than you would think in terms of just reading a piece of paper about muscle. You know, how the sort of dynamic relationships of the muscle are probably paramount, which is sort of pretty logical because muscles are a contractile organ. Scars within muscle, so that's another one that I see quite commonly. because you've got, you know, you've got this analogy of sort of the leaves onto the branches onto the tree. Now imagine if the tree wasn't sort of perfectly formed,
mm-hmm.
right? Or the tree was sort of injured and somebody chopped like sort of five branches off,
mm-hmm.
and then you've got this asymmetric pull of the muscle. So a lot of old muscle injury presents with sort of chronic ache. People go, you know, I can kind of remember when I hurt it, but it never quite got better.
Mm, yes.
So that's sort of a lot of muscle sources of pain come from that.
Yeah, we're talking about muscles today, specifically how muscles age, but, you know, muscle pain is something that we all live with. If you have a question for Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon, you can call us at 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be right back after this break on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Yik. Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon in the studio for his monthly show. Today we're talking about how muscles age. And before the break, Dr. Rajesh, you gave us a real 101 on muscle structure and its function and what it means when we experience this general umbrella term muscle pain. But, you know, today we're talking about aging, specifically muscle loss. I mean, is it natural for us to experience muscle loss, and is aging even the right word for it?
Do leaves fall off trees?
Yes.
It's actually that simple.
Mm.
So muscle's an interesting kind of thing, because you can't, let's say that you've, yeah, I really like this analogy of the tree, you know, sort of looking out the trees out the window. I thought, you know, that really does explain what muscles are like. So in aging, what happens is the leaves fall off the tree, but the size of the tree that you've had depends largely on what you did when you were younger.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were sort of vigorous physically when you were younger, and you sort of developed large muscles and sort of strong muscles, then you have big trees. So when you're older, even if the leaves fall off the tree, you still got a reasonable amount of shade. So that's what happens when you get older. When you get older, you tend to lose the individual sort of leaves off the tree. Mm-hmm. You tend to lose the individual muscle units, but not the overall structure. So the overall structure largely stays intact. So that's why part of sort of good aging involves making an investment when you were younger to make sure that you actually maintain your muscle bulk so that, you know, you have large trees. And then when you get older, even though your leaves are less, you still have some degree of shade from that. So to answer your question, is loss of muscle or sarcopenia inevitable as a result of age? Answer is yes.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, absolutely. What are the factors controlling it? Well, they're all genetic, but the sort of expression of those genetic factors would include things particularly like drop in hormone levels. So, you know, estrogen, testosterone. We know that if we give elderly men testosterone, they increase the lean muscle mass. You know, that's a basic hormone that's required to build muscle as testosterone. Yeah. Other things like thyroid hormone, that's something that's pretty important as well. Insulin-like growth factors. You know, people think of muscles as just sort of generating these sort of forces, but muscles actually have a huge endocrine function. Muscles secrete almost 1,000 different factors when muscles are contracting. And a lot of those factors are involved in whole body regulation of metabolism, you know, in terms of appetite. So, you know, if you exercise very vigorously, your appetite goes down. So there's actually a mechanism by which that happens. The muscle produces certain proteins, and those proteins suppress appetite. So the muscle is sort of both a mover of the body as well as, you know, mover of the endocrine system.
Okay, we have two callers on the line, so I'll get to Richard first. For the other caller, please do stay on the line. Please bear with us. Richard, you have a question about back injury?
Oh, yes, Eric. Thank you very much. Actually, about 10 days before the Chinese New Year, I had a fall after playing badminton. And I went in to change and took my shower after changing and all this. I was actually busy talking to a friend of mine. And I slipped and I fell onto the curb of a step. It's a concrete step, or rather a cement step. It's like a ladder kind of a step. So I hit my lower spine spinal cord, and then as well as on my right buttock, especially on the rump. Now, I have done the necessary x-rays, and I've seen the doctors, and they told me there's nothing wrong with the spinal. But however, the strange thing is that as I was recovering, my spinal cord and my rump started to itch, and it's still itching now. Hmm. Any ideas, doctor?
Okay.
Anything that you can help?
Okay.
I mean, I don't mind listening on the radio.
That's okay. So, quick question. Are you over 50 or under 50?
Oh, I'm over 50. I'm 61.
Okay, so I guess
I'm playing very active by me.
Okay. Do you notice any bruising anywhere?
No. There is no bruises and there is no blue-black marks.
Okay.
On both sides, nothing.
Okay. Did your urine change to a dark color after the injury for a few days?
I'm not aware of it.
Can't remember. Okay. All right. You know, I can certainly, I can't give you a spot diagnosis, but I can give you a guesstimate over the phone. Over the air, all right?
Okay. We'll answer your question on air, Richard. Thank you for calling.
Okay. So, Richard, itching after an injury is usually a sign of this thing called mast cells. So, mast cells are particular cells that live under the layer of skin in deeper layers. And mast cells, spelled M-A-S-T, mast cells actually contain a protein called histamine. So if you tell me that you have this sort of constant itching sensation in the area that was hurt, it's most likely that you've got some mast cell overactivity. That means that you injured the area, the mast cells are there as part of sort of the healing and repair response, and you're getting an itch from that. It happens very commonly post-surgery with wounds as well. When wounds are in the healing phase, people will say, look, you know, I don't have the pain anymore, but I've got this crazy mad itch.
You hear a lot about that, right?
And that itching is just coming from a histamine effect. So it sounds like what you have is just a histamine effect post-injury.
Something that antihistamines would address?
Yeah, that's certainly an idea. Or you can just stretch and wait. You know, it has to go away.
It will go away by itself?
Yeah.
Okay. We also have Peter on the line. Peter, you have a question?
Oh, yes. Good afternoon, BFM, and also a special good afternoon to Dr. Rajesh.
Yes, Peter. Hi, good afternoon.
Yeah, my question is not too much on injuries or things like that, but rather in scratching my head, over the legendary Usain Bolt. We are talking about, you know, how muscular and, whatnot. But I do believe that, Usain Bolt's muscles cannot be stronger than a bodybuilder. All right? Mm. And at the same time, you explained to me saying that more flexible, but I do not believe that his muscles are more flexible than one of a gymnast. Mm. So why is he so special that, he can run so fast?
That's a great question for the topic. Thank you so much. We'll answer that on air.
Thank you.
I'll listen to a radio.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay, so now Usain Bolt actually comes from a particular ethnic group. And that particular ethnic group is renowned for having fast sprinters from, you know, whatever the country they represent, their gene pool is the same.
So it's not a myth.
No, it's not a myth, actually. It is actually his genetics. So over millennia, his sort of lineage has a particular gene. And that particular gene allows for muscles not to be stronger, not to be more flexible, but to contract and recover more quickly. So every time, you imagine if a gun fires, right? The gun has to fire and then recover for the next bullet to load to fire. That sort of ability to recover from the shot is basically the difference between Usain Bolt and the average person. You know, so that's why when they ask him about his training diet, you know, he goes Kentucky Fried Chicken and nuggets.
Do not try this at home.
Do not try this at home. Because that's his genetic, you know, that's his genetic gift. Is to have some crazy fast recovery of muscle fibers. And that's why he can do a sprint so quickly. You know, he wouldn't be able to do a marathon to save his life.
Right.
But he can certainly do a sprint because that's the muscle fiber type that he has. Remember, I talked about type 1, type 2. Mm-hmm. One of them is fast twitch, one of them is slow twitch. So that means that one recovers quickly, one can sustain activity longer. Now, most activity muscles are actually... slow recovery. So that's why you tend to get sort of lactic acidosis and things like that. Mm-hmm. But if you happen to have activity muscles that recover quickly, then you got the Usain Bolt.
All right. Okay. Let's quickly address a question on WhatsApp as well from Savas Lee. I have an L4 L5 disc herniation and it's compressing my sciatic nerve. My question is, when the nerve goes crazy, the muscles around it, i.e. the leg, contract like crazy. Why is this the case? And would it cause muscle atrophy?
Okay. So this is a lovely question because it shows the relationship between the whole sort of play on things. The nerve is like the wire that carries electricity to the motors, and the motors are the muscles. Now, if you go to the fuse box and you shake the wire, then all the motors are going to go crazy because they're not getting the correct kind of electricity. The question is, so that explains the first part, why the muscles contract like crazy, because you're irritating the nerve sending electric signals to the muscles when it shouldn't, and then it contracts like crazy. Whether it causes muscle atrophy or not really depends at the end of the day on how damaged that wire is. So that nerve which comes up from your back is like electrical wire. At the minute, it's just being disturbed. It's not being cut. It's not being sort of restricted. But if the nerve does get damaged, then the muscles which are supplied by the nerve will correspondingly get damaged as well. That's why one of the indications for surgery when you have a disc pressing on a nerve, I mean, the pain is one thing. You know, the pain will go away. But weakness, like objective muscle weakness, and muscle weakness that is progressive or persistent is an indication for surgery. It's sort of a very clear black and white indication for surgery.
That you have to do something.
That something needs to be done, or you will lose that sort of group. You will lose part of the function of those groups of muscles. So then you have to ask yourself, you know, do I particularly need that function or not? If you say, well, you know, I can kind of live with it, or I can live without that function, then you can leave it alone. But you know, if it's something important like being able to raise the foot when you're walking, right, then obviously that's important.
Mm. We're talking about muscles and how they age with consultant orthopedic surgeon Dr. Rajesh Singh today. May, I know you're on the line waiting, so please bear with us as we go for a quick break. We'll get back to you after the market update. You're listening to BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back to the show with me, T. Xiao Yi. Consultant orthopedic surgeon Dr. Rajesh Singh is in the studio with us. We're talking about muscles and how they age. We've had a caller waiting on the line, May. Thank you for your patience. You have a question for us, May?
Hello, doctor.
Yes, hi, May.
Yeah, I'd like to inquire regarding the older generation or senior citizen. Since they have a very less mobile life, and those who are bedridden, would they be losing muscles if they lie down often? Or is there any way to develop muscles? Is there a way, maybe you can give us some ideas what the senior citizens can do?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your question, May. Dr. Rajesh will answer on air.
Okay, May. The thing about getting older and building muscle is it's really an uphill battle because you need extra protein intake when you're building muscle. When you're older, the body doesn't utilize the protein that you give it so well. So you tend to need purer forms of protein like egg whites, maybe protein supplements. You know, you can say, well, you know, I eat meat, but there's a digestive breakdown, reabsorption process involved in there. Then the second challenge that you have in much older age is how to move the muscle correctly. What are the exercises that you have to do? And that's really, you know, I think the realm of some professional help. You know, maybe a physiotherapist, occupational therapist, somebody who can give you sort of a simple repertoire of activities to be able to do in order to build specific sets of muscles. I'm not such a, you know, build it for its sake kind of situation. I'm more sort of practical. What are the things you need to be able to do? You know, you need to be able to open a car door. You need to be able to get in and out of a car. You need to be able to navigate steps. You need to be able to go in and out of the bathroom. All the sorts of practical things, those tasks can actually be broken down into the individual steps for you. And so what may seem like a just I cannot do this becomes a 15-step process and you are stuck at step 7. And so, you know, you have a particular exercise that's prescribed to you for step 7 so that you can go from step 1 to step 15 very smoothly without getting stuck on step 7. So the answer to your question is exercise prescription for the elderly should happen from a professional and should happen in the context of a functional requirement for it to be meaningful. You know, not just sort of, you know, go to the park, wave your arms around, wave your legs around. That sort of, to me, doesn't really make much sense.
Well, it's going to help you to generally feel better but not address your specific muscle problems?
No, it's just, you know, you feel better because you're out in the park shaking your arms and legs. I mean, it's nice to get into sunshine. You know, like the structured stuff like Tai Chi, Qigong, all that's excellent, right? Because it goes through full range of movement. But it's that sort of uninitiated, you know, just go jalan-jalan. It doesn't really do much beyond give you some social sense of being out in the open.
But what kind of exercises are we looking at?
Very simple 1 kilo, 2 kilo dumbbell type exercises for the upper limb. Specific movements, you know, steady your body, move your leg in this direction. Step forward once, twice, three times. Step backwards once, twice, three times. But don't just do it, you know, understand what's happening to your body. If you're sort of swaying and shaking all over the place while you're doing it, then you're obviously doing it wrong.
All right. We have a question on WhatsApp from Chua. I think I dislocated my shoulder when I was under 10, landing with my arms straight during a basketball game. So I went to Sifu at that time to sort of relocate it. And it's been over 20 years now, on and off. And now if I were to move my shoulder wrongly, it gives me a dislocation type of pain where I have to pause my movement. What can he do?
Okay, so that's luxio erector. Luxio erector basically means that you dislocate the shoulder downwards, right? So your arm sort of stuck over your head. That has a pretty classic pattern of things that it tears and destroys. So at this stage, what you should probably be doing, you should probably get a professional examination that says, okay, well, of the elements which stabilize the shoulder, these are the elements that aren't working. Out of the elements that aren't working, what is changeable without surgery? What is changeable with strengthening, reconditioning, training? And once you have gone through that, then the symptom that you're describing is called instability. That feeling that, oh no, my shoulder is going to dislocate, right? So you need a sophisticated examination first. It's sort of very unfortunate that the general public believes an investigation over a clinical examination. You know, so the most common question I get asked is, what did, you know, the X-ray, MRI, CT scan show? Nobody asks what were the physical examination findings. And, you know, here I am at a major private university trying to explain to my medical students that first you take a history, then you do the examination, then based on your anamnesis, you then formulate a differential diagnosis, and then you go to the investigation.
And that is supposed to confirm your...
No, the investigation, when you undertake an investigation, you already have a pretest probability in mind. And the purpose of the investigation is to add weight to that pretest probability. If the pretest probability is already 1, you don't need an investigation, right? So the investigation has to be for the purpose of giving you a direction in your treatment. It's not a fishing expedition. So that's why for this gentleman here who had the injury at 10, I would say get a sophisticated examination first. There's some very good physiotherapists out there. I work with a lot of them. Even go to a physiotherapist as a first port of call. Make sure that they're a good physiotherapist. Let them examine you. You know, let them say, well, look, these are the muscle imbalances that I see. Let me try and fix those muscle imbalances. And if you can't, then, you know, get the next order of help.
All right. Also, another question on WhatsApp. I have a very serious hyperextended knee. Is that caused by my posture muscle?
Okay, if it's one knee, then that's not normal. If it's both knees, both elbows, and you can touch your toes, you can touch your sort of hands flat on the floor, that just means you're hyperlax. So the things which hold joints in place are primarily ligaments. Those are called the primary stabilizers, and muscles are the secondary stabilizers. So if you're some serious hyperextension, you're more likely to have generalized hyperlaxity with your ligaments rather than have a problem with your muscles.
What exactly is a hyperextended knee?
Okay, so if you stand straight and you look sort of sideways, you look like two sort of things just vertical. A hyperextended knee means like it's like a bent paperclip or a bent ski pole or like a bent stick kind of as it were. So that sort of bend backwards, as it were. That's right. What a hyperextension is.
Right. Okay. All right. So going back then, I think it really links to the question that May had earlier about, you know, how can we improve, you know, the muscles that we have. Mm. And since we know that muscle loss is inevitable, the leaves will fall off the tree. Protein intake in our diet is one of the things you mentioned. But, you know, vegan diets are becoming increasingly common. Is anyone at danger there?
Suffer.
We're going to get angry vegans calling in.
But it's quite funny, isn't it? If you think the whole idea of, you know, angry vegans. I want to imagine a Far Side cartoon about that. You need protein. You need adequate amounts of protein. You need adequate amounts of class 1 protein. Class 1 protein comes only from naturally, you know, meats, eggs. You know, if you're vegetarian, vegan, and you need to build muscle, then, you know, I put patients on egg as medicine. You know, so I'll say, yes, look, I know you're vegetarian, but if I gave you a pill for your disorder, you would take it? They say, yes. I say, well, for the next 6 weeks, I'm giving you exercise. This is the specific exercise that my physiotherapist will walk through with you. But in that 6 weeks, you need to have 2 egg whites a day, every day for 6 days a week. 1 day a week you can have off.
Mm.
And at the end of the 6 weeks, they've built muscle and they say, hey, look, you know, I've got no pain. I've got great function. I got muscle. I go, well, you know, you took your medicine.
Mm.
So I think if you're vegetarian or vegan and you don't have a specific deficit, I don't think that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if your diet is protein poor, and you have a need to build it, then it's just medicine.
And you need to see what your priorities are.
Yeah, well, I mean, like I say, it's just medicine. You know, people always complain. They go, oh, you know, I have to take this tablet, I have to take that tablet. You know, this one got that side effect, that one got that side effect. And I say it's very simple. In the old days, get sick and die. Very short line, right? Now the line's a lot longer. So where on the line do you want to be?
Mm. Okay, a question from Susan on WhatsApp. I'm a yoga teacher who is hypermobile. I have pain in my sciatica area, but no spine issues, and she's been cleared by a doctor. Likely a piriformis pain, according to the doctor. Mm. The pain shoots from her right rump down the back of the leg. Can it be just managed through exercises?
Okay, so that one, you need a proper diagnosis. There's a common syndrome called subgluteal syndrome. That means that piriformis, unfortunately, is sort of the innocent bystander. It gets shot in every drive-by shooting. But, you know, the situation's a lot more complex than that. There's a whole bunch of structures that go on under there. Now, you may have a subgluteal syndrome. Subgluteal syndrome is very easy to manage under using minimal invasive surgical techniques. You know, no general anesthetic, no big cuts of the skin, no months and months of downtime. And it should cure the sciatica. So I would say get a proper assessment for subgluteal syndrome first. And then decide what to do.
All right. And Melvin on WhatsApp as well. I have C3, C6 spondylolisthesis as confirmed by an MRI. That's the investigation you were talking about, Dr. Rajesh.
Yes.
I have numbness in my left thumb or index finger. What can be done to get rid of the numbness? He has no pain and he wants to know whether surgery is required.
What's the status of your median nerve, Melvin? How you know? How I know? So this is the problem with an investigation. What the investigation has basically done is it's given you a red herring. You know, you're not giving me physical examination findings. You're not telling me this is the power of my flexor digital profundus. This is the flexor power of my flexor pollicis longus. You know, this is the power of my flexor carpi radialis. You know, you're not. This is the problem with investigations. Investigations basically give you a label. And then you run around trying to look for a solution to that label.
Well, to be fair, this is the only thing that Melvin has to figure out where he is. So what should he do? Let's get away from that. What should he do?
Thumb index. Yeah, so it sounds like a median nerve story, right? So you probably need to get your median nerve assessed from basically after it leaves the C3 to C6 root. Well, basically, I mean, median nerve doesn't have any C3 in it, right? So you're barking up the wrong tree already. So, okay, let's try and calm down. You need to get...
Yes, please do.
You need to get an assessment of what the level of your nerve entrapment is. And don't just assume that it's at the level of the neck where the MRI shows.
So let's help Melvin as well. What kind of questions should he be asking?
He should be asking that question, you know, have we excluded every other level of potential nerve entrapment from the tip of my finger right up to the root of my neck?
Okay. All right. Melvin, hope this helps you. So going back to aging muscles, you know, we're talking about all these things that we're hoping to be able to do to halt or delay the progression of muscle loss. Is it ever too late to do things like the exercises and to include more protein in the diet, things like that?
No, I don't think it's ever too late. The lovely thing about muscle is it keeps responding until the day we expire. So, you know, you can be 99 or 100, and if you work a particular muscle, that particular muscle will grow. It's like, you know, keeping a little pot plant as a project. And you can decide, well, you know, I want this little muscle that wiggles my index finger to be bigger. You know, stick a weight on it, work on it. In 3 months, the muscle will be bigger. Absolutely sort of physical reality, the physical law that will become bigger.
Mm.
Whether it'll stay after you exercise, stop exercising or not is something else.
Or like you said, if you prescribe, you know, eating egg whites for 2 weeks, if you, you know, stop doing that, what's going to happen?
It atrophies down again. Mm. So what? So this is the problem with the genetic potential. So everybody has a particular genetic build. Now, if you alter that build, you're kind of committed to keeping that build. Because if you stop making the efforts to maintain that build, you go down back to your genetic sort of potential, as it were.
Okay. And, you know, what about things like drug treatment or hormone therapy? What's the role there, if at all?
Okay. Drug treatment for muscle, probably nil, because it's largely hormone-driven. Hormones, yes, estrogen, testosterone, thyroid. Calcium and vitamin D have a big role in muscle. You know, we keep talking about calcium and vitamin D in bone, but calcium and vitamin D is also very important in the function of muscle. So you may have a large muscle bulk but poor function. And one of the things that I find if I start people on calcium and vitamin D for osteoporosis is they say they feel better and stronger. So they think the medicine has worked within 2 weeks. Well, it doesn't work for bone within 2 weeks. It takes 2 years to work for bone. But that immediate short-term gain that they get with the calcium and vitamin D for muscle function is something that most patients will be aware of.
All right. And your final message about maintaining healthy muscles and delaying muscle loss, hopefully?
If you don't use it, you lose it.
Mm.
You know, really, really very simple.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Rajesh. I've been speaking to Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon, about muscles and how they age. You're listening to The Bigger Picture on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.